Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Friday and time for our week in review, starting with the verdict in the case of 19-year-old Owen LaBrie. He's accused of raping a former fellow student at an elite New Hampshire boarding school. This afternoon, a jury found LaBrie not guilty of felony aggravated sexual assault. They did find him guilty of misdemeanor sexual assault and of using a computer to lure a minor. Now, LaBrie took the stand in his own defense earlier this week and claimed he did not have sex with the alleged victim, who was then a 15-year-old at Concord's St. Paul School.
I mean, I'd reached for a condom. I'd taken it out.
And you thought sex has happened?
Yes.
And you want all of these people here to believe that after all that time spent thinking about her and having foreplay, you just stopped?
I didn't just stop. We kissed more afterwards, but I didn't have sex with her.
The case has raised numerous questions about the nature of consent and teen sexuality and about school tradition, since the contact between the two students happened during an annual St. Paul's ritual known as Senior Salute. LaBrie's defense attorney, J.W. Carney, said outside the courtroom earlier this week that it's the culture at St. Paul's School that needs to change.
To wink at traditions like Senior Salute is such an outdated practice that it should be immediately halted, because it has all kinds of people who end up being affected negatively.
So let's talk about the case and other stories of the week with our Week in Review panel. Joining us is Nancy Gertner, former federal judge and current professor at Harvard Law School. Nancy, great to see you again.
Great to be here.
Also with us is Jim Sturgis, executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Jim, good to have you back.
Good to be here.
So Nancy, let's just start with you and your reaction to the verdict in the case of Owen LaBrie.
It's a compromise verdict. The threshold for deciding that someone has been guilty of misdemeanor assault is a very low threshold. It takes essentially an assault as a threatened act. And so the foreplay and the banter beforehand could be the threat of sex, which didn't then take place. The jury could believe that. The acquittal of the aggravated felonious sexual assault, suggests that they took his account of what had happened. What's interesting about the case is that this is the kind of case that actually would probably not have been brought 10 years ago. We've mm-hmm. come a long way in terms of recognizing that this young woman's behavior after the encounter and before doesn't necessarily mean that there wasn't a rape. That is to say, the things that she said, the fact that she went into the room with him, but it also doesn't mean that there was a rape. It could go in either direction. And in a situation where you're talking about a criminal charge, the jury has to pick one narrative beyond a reasonable doubt.
Right.
So the fact that they chose a not guilty verdict here is attributable, it seems to me, to the ambiguity of the evidence and the standard.
Well, so that's what I was curious about, because, I mean, obviously we don't have time to go into detail about all the evidence that was brought in this case. But, you know, there wasn't necessarily any physical evidence, because the alleged victim, she didn't go seek medical attention for a day or two afterwards. I mean, is that potentially one takeaway from this case, that we are still at a place where, short of having sort of absolute physical evidence, it is hard to try these cases?
It's very hard to try these cases in a criminal court because of the standard. But let me repeat, things like her not immediately going to seek help 10, 15 years ago would have meant that the prosecutor said, I'm not going to bring these charges. This prosecutor rightly recognized that women who've been traumatized sometimes don't seek help. But the fact that she didn't seek help immediately thereafter means either rape happened or it didn't. And that was the ambiguity, I think, that led to this verdict.
Jim, your thoughts?
Well, I won't try to get into legal stuff because I'm sitting next to Nancy Gertner, okay?
Fair enough.
So let me talk a little bit about the school, because I think actually the school's an interesting part of this. And it's a unique school. St. Paul's School is 100% of its students are boarders. Now, we're used to, and I think some of the more salacious ways of talking about this case was, oh, all these elite schools are this way. Well, a lot of them have had issues like this, Milton Academy and others. But this is a very unique school where culture matters a ton. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is 100% of the kids are boarders. They're on a 2,000-acre campus. If you think about that, I think Phillips Academy, which has a huge campus, is 500 acres, right? You can get lost anywhere. And it's also a school that has, if you will, its sort of pedagogical theory is one of self-direction, having kids direct themselves. So you've got, of course, house parents who are there, and they're supposed to guide the children or the kids along the way to becoming adults and all the rest. But I think the school probably has a lot of soul searching going forward. I don't mean just, I think it would be crude to say that all the senior salutes were done in the way that Owen LaBrie was accused of doing. A lot of them were much more innocent than that, and they're certainly going to look at this, and I think you won't see any more senior salutes, whether they're innocent or not innocent.
Right.
But it goes much, much deeper than that as to how they should think about acculturating kids to actually become adults, to respect each other. They've been a long way there.
Yeah. Nancy, you're shaking your head. And in fact, I mean, in the introduction to our conversation, we played that tape from J.W. Carney, who outside the courtroom earlier this week was basically making a very similar point, pointing to the culture of the school. Now, there's probably sort of legal strategy behind him doing that with the media. But I mean, is it a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. You know, it's interesting. When I went to school 9 million years ago, there were parietals, which is that you were banned from doing things, from having men in your room, et cetera, et cetera. We now have given all of that up, for the most part, have co-ed dorms, particularly in colleges. But the consequences of that freedom are what we're seeing in these cases, which then, instead of being a culture, as Jim was saying, that is sort of shaped by adults, it is shaped by the kids with all of these ambiguities.
Hmm. Now, what about the issue of how is it, and we'll stay in the court of law with you, Judge Gertner, how can you get a clear reading on consent, especially between, you know, the alleged victim at the time was 15?
Right. Well, let me say something about that for a moment. This is not statutory rape in New Hampshire, because New Hampshire has what's called a Romeo and Juliet law, which is that sex with a minor is only statutory rape if there's more than 4 years between the minor and the perpetrator. So she's 15, he's 17. It's not statutory rape. How can you ever get a clear ruling? No, you can't. Essentially, these are credibility decisions, that this is a he said, she said, and all of the social values that come into play in the jury are played out in this courtroom. I don't know the answer to this question, but I would have liked to have known the age of some of the jury members, because I suspect there's a generational difference between the way we look at these, between one generation looks at these kinds of issues and another. But they are inevitably credibility determinations.
Mm. And Jim, do you have any more thoughts on this before we move on to the next topic?
You know, I really don't.
Yeah,
I really don't. I have two daughters. We were talking about this before, and it's one of those things where you can't imagine what mom and dad are actually going through, who are thinking they're supposed to be there to protect, and not in a sort of all male way, but you're supposed to protect your kid. And I would think that one of the things that's going through the school's mind is not only what they do next in order to take away this story from the front pages. Mm-hmm. But it's much more, what do they do next to actually change who they are?
Right. Well, let's move on now to news from another case, but this one is one that we thought was in our past, and that is the case of Jahar Tsarnaev, because this week, the judge in that case, Federal Judge George O'Toole, denied a motion to release the jury list pending Tsarnaev's appeal. However, WBUR this week landed the first extended public interview with one of the jurors. He's 23-year-old Kayvon Fagan. And here's what he said was his most important reason for deciding that Tsarnaev deserved the death penalty.
I thought about it, obviously, a lot. But even with what I think there was influence from his brother, he still chose to leave that bomb there for about 4.5 minutes. So it's hard to get away from that. You know, you could try to brush it up, but there is just no brushing anything like that up, as much as you want to, as much as I, you know, wanted to.
Once again, that's 23-year-old Kayvon Fagan, one of the jurors in the Tsarnaev case, giving his first extended public interview to WBUR. Nancy, let's start with you on this. I mean, first of all, what's your thought about a juror speaking out even before the jury list has been made public or unsealed?
That is, he has obviously an entitlement to speak. The whole situation is very troubling because what happens is that since the judge has not released the jury list, since the voir dire itself is sealed, what happens then is that you have jurors speaking out and creating the narrative 100%. You don't have any way of evaluating what this man is saying because you have absolutely no other information.
Right.
I've never heard of a situation, candidly, in which jury lists and the voir dire have been kept sealed for this length of time when there was no finding. The judge, it's a First Amendment issue. You all should be concerned about that.
We are.
When there's no finding that the jurors were threatened, there's no such finding. There's no finding that the jury needed to be anonymous. He made no such finding. And what's worse, the people that you are ostensibly protecting are speaking. So there really is no justification. The only justification, the notion that you keep this sealed pending appeal, it would have made my life easier as a judge if the press knew nothing about what I was doing. But that is not the rule. It certainly makes things easier. The rule is you can only keep this information sealed if there is a threat, a national security issue, and in the absence of that, there's no justification for your not having access to it.
I mean, when he says pending appeal, though, could it be such that if the media started speaking more intensively with jurors, that it could, and that information getting out there could affect Tsarnaev's appeal going forward?
Sure. The First Amendment is incredibly messy and, you know, a
pesky
pain.
First Amendment.
That's right. But the fact of the matter is, you know, there's litigation now, numbers of cases about whether Judge Young in an earlier case had a right to hold on to jury lists for 10 days. This has been 4 months. So yes, things can happen, but that's the nature of our process.
Right. Well, Jim, let me ask you, first of all, just what's your reaction to, you know, hearing that piece of tape about why Fagan said he opted for the death penalty for Tsarnaev?
Well, I thought it was a really powerful interview, and in part the power comes from the fact that he's the first person we've heard from, right? So to Nancy's point, and you know, I think about what Nance just said about if there's a threat, you could actually keep things, you could keep the juror list from the public. And I had assumed throughout this process that's what it was. They were thinking that the jurors could be put at risk and all the rest. I hadn't followed that closely. When I started reading about it, you realize that this is really about the judge's decision to cite the trial in a specific place, not wanting to have that come back to haunt him to some degree, right? And not wanting the defense attorneys to have access to social media from the jurors who might be, they might be able to go back and say, oh, well, you were actually accessing information about the trial. Whether it's a question about where the trial was cited or whether it's fear of a media frenzy, those are two really bad reasons for keeping the jurors'
right.
Names and identities and access to them from the public.
Mm. Right, and the defense has access to the social media because they have the names of the jurors.
That's right.
So they know who to look for.
They know. That's right. But there's a certain messiness that comes from public trials. And when I talk about threats to the jurors, typically it was in mob cases where there were concrete threats to these particular jurors. I've never seen a situation like this before where there's no evidence like that, no findings.
Mm. Well, let's hear a little bit more of what Kayvon Fagan told WBUR's David Boeri and Jack Lepiarz. He told them that he was actually shocked to hear Tsarnaev apologize at the formal sentencing hearing at the end of the trial, and that he said he had no idea, and this makes sense because you know, the jury wasn't allowed to know what the public was talking about, but he did not know that the Richard family and others had asked the Justice Department earlier to drop or take the death penalty off the table. Let's listen.
They have to make the best decisions and hopefully, you know, ask for an outcome that would be best for their families. But, you know, that could have also disrupted the process in terms of making it an unadulterated decision by, you know, a jury. So that could have changed the outcome, I'm sure, in retrospect, but I didn't know.
If you had known that, would you have changed your vote?
If I had known that, I probably would change my vote.
Now, Nancy, I have to say, I actually struggle with that a little bit because, of course, he didn't know that and he shouldn't have known that because that was a conversation that was going on independent of what was happening in the courtroom. And yet it still sort of stays with me that had he known, he wouldn't, I mean, had he known what others wanted, he would not have voted for the death penalty. I'm not quite sure how to make sense of that.
Well, first is a question, that data, which is what the victims wanted in terms of the ultimate punishment, should have been something that the prosecutor took into account in going for the death penalty. once they made the decision to go for the death penalty, and there is a penalty phase that we saw, the victim's belief as to what the outcome should be actually arguably is not relevant to that. That's something that the jury should decide. But I think when this record is unsealed, we may find out about a lot of information that was kept from both the public and the jury. Everything that the defendant wrote, there was reference in the sentencing to a letter that he had written, was ostensibly covered up as under the special administrative measures. If, hypothetically, he had written a letter that said, I apologize, please don't follow me, and that was sealed, that would be very troubling because so much of this case was about him. Right. So to what degree was the actual trial affected by, now not the sealing of the proceedings, but the sealing of the record? I think it's a very, very troubling case and a very troubling outcome.
Jim, your thoughts?
I guess that when I think about the case and how it's been handled throughout the process, I guess two things come to mind. Hearing an incredibly thoughtful person on the radio talking about this, who has the role of deciding whether someone lives or dies. One is the way the setting of the trial was something that I never really liked very much. I thought it should have been moved from the beginning. I think that just would have allowed for greater transparency of access to information. The second thing is, not to be cynical, but he is coming out with a book. And I think that just because he's coming out with a book and has written about it doesn't mean that he has actually thought clearly about this. I would think that the Richard family's view on this should really have no material effect on how he made his decision whatsoever, to be quite honest, because there are many, many other people who are also affected. So how do you choose a partial decision on the basis of a family that's been hurt incredibly? But there are many others as well.
Right. Well, let's all take a deep breath and step back and change gears entirely, because there's one more big story for this week that we should talk about, and that has to do with the beleaguered green line of the MBTA. Because this week, T officials revealed that the long-awaited, still waiting for, green line extension into Somerville and Medford could cost $1 billion more than initially projected. Now, we spoke with Transportation Secretary Stephanie Pollack about that this week, and she said that the state still has the possibility of mothballing the entire project on the table if they can't come up with another solution. And she said the original deal with the feds, because they got federal funding for the green line extension, was that costs for the extension would be split 50-50 between the state and the federal government. And then she said this.
Part of that deal was the federal number doesn't change. So that means if this becomes a $3 billion project, now the Commonwealth is on the hook for twice as much. And we have to at least ask ourselves whether that investment makes sense. What I've been saying, what the governor has been saying, is that canceling or mothballing the project is not our first choice. We want to get back to a project we can afford, but we can't pursue the project at any cost to the taxpayers.
Jim, I'm teeing this one up for you.
Well, I noticed the cadence in your voice. You started talking about this was much more light and
not.
This sort of tells you something about the state of the news this week.
Is a green line catastrophe.
This is a catastrophe. Look, this one I think is pretty simple. This is a really good project. There are many T expansions, and Pioneer has been out there saying, no, don't do it. This is one that has ridership. It has potential for housing development that would meet the needs of a lot of millennials, a lot of younger professionals, that sort of stuff that, from a policy perspective, we absolutely have to do right now. But it's turning out to be the big dig without a bunch of tunnels. And we've seen it go from $1.4 billion to $2 billion to $3 billion, and we really don't have a shovel in the ground yet. And all this is through a piece of legislation that was giving the T much more flexibility in how it managed the project. It's called Construction Manager General Contractor.
Which was supposed to be a good thing.
Supposed to be a good thing. But what it has happened is they've handed over the keys to the design and to the cost estimates and all the rest to the vendor. Which includes, like, I think it's White, Skanska, Kiewit, right? These folks have used it as an opportunity to pitch their number, the highest number possible, to make sure they don't have any cost overruns, they say. But we've seen it go up and up and up. I think it's a huge problem. My view on this is they should just go out and rebid it all from the beginning, because currently what they're going to do is they try to work with these folks. They're going to say to them, all right, $3 billion. In order to make sure we don't go over, we're going to peel back all the bells and whistles, all the good stuff that we wanted.
So deliver less than we originally were promising the people of Somerville and Medford.
Yeah, negotiate against yourself. It's a pretty dumb place to be.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, what I struggle with is I look through the entire presentation that was made to the Fiscal Control Board. And I have to say, it's a tough pill to swallow for me to hear the state say that they're not quite sure how this happened. I mean, that seems to be the message, that they're trying to figure out how did it jump $1 billion in 16 months. But, I mean, I feel like it shouldn't be that much of a mystery.
It shouldn't be. There are a couple things going on here. One is that the MBTA is terrible. And Mike Dukakis is absolutely right about this. Look, the planning department and the project execution department at the MBTA is a shambles. If we had, there's a guy named David Perini who used to run the agency that oversaw a lot of the vertical construction, the building construction for the state. His name is David Perini. He's a really smart guy. If he was there, I could tell you that this would not happen, because he was a true professional who oversaw this, did not give up, if you will, the keys to the kingdom to the vendor, just as we did it in the Big Dig. We said to, you know, Parsons Brinckerhoff and Bechtel, you tell us what we need to do to manage the project. We have to stop that way of procuring projects.
Mm-hmm. Nancy, any thoughts on the Green Line?
I'm a writer. So I just think that Boston public transportation is shockingly bad. And whatever it and I think that that's part of the reason why the Olympics failed, is the notion of having so many more people come to a city that could barely get its own citizens where they should go just was beyond anyone's belief. So something needs to be done.
Right. And this is a project that I have to say a rare project in terms of Massachusetts policy circles, because I think just about everyone agrees that it's an important one to get completed, that there are great benefits to be had from it. Just finding the right way forward seems to be the biggest challenge right now. Well, we've got just enough time left for our hubbubs, and those are the stories that maybe didn't make it to the top of the newscast, as we say in the biz here, the radio biz. Jim, should we start with you? What's your hubbub?
Sure. I've got a seasonal one. This is a back-to-school hubbub, and it's a Boston Magazine article that I thought was really important, which is that we're seeing homeschooling take off even in Massachusetts, the highest-performing state in the nation, a wealthy area. Even in wealthy districts, homeschooling is taking off. Around the country, we've seen it go from about 2% of kids to almost 4% of kids.
Wow.
And we're seeing here in Massachusetts, the current number is around 30,000. The charter schools have about 40,000 kids in them. It's a big and growing number. And what's really interesting, it's happening even in places like Newton and Cambridge. And on the other side, I think happy news is places like Cambridge are, I think, being thoughtful about this and trying to make sure they can meet the needs of the kids. So they say, if you want to participate in a sports program, even though you're a homeschooler, go for it. You want to take a course, go for it. This is kind of what we should be doing for kids and parents, is giving them all the options they really want.
Huh. And do we have any sense on why the numbers are growing in Massachusetts?
The article goes into it to some degree, and it says this. It says, look, some people are really tired of the testing regimes. Uh-huh. That's one. Second, they're really not very, even though we're the highest performing state in the country, they're really not amped up about the quality very often. And I think the third piece of it is, kids learn at different paces a lot. And if you have a kid who has unique issues, and I don't mean issues in a negative way, but I mean, kid learns in a different way. I mean, we know from all the data, there are some kids who start off slower who ultimately do a lot better than kids who learn faster. You can meet those kids' needs more effectively.
Right. You know, this makes me think that, of course, the parents who can afford and have the resources to sort of homeschool their kids, that's an option for them. But once again, the parents who can't and who rely on their neighborhood schools or the schools they're assigned to,
I keep
thinking about them as well.
Absolutely right.
Nancy, you're hubbub?
I'm hubbubless. I am hubbubless. And it seems to me that in a week in which the stock market drove everyone crazy and these kinds of verdicts were, and these kinds of issues were being played back and forth, I can think of nothing remotely funny to say.
Okay.
So I'm completely hubbubless.
We're giving you a pass because you had to really carry both of us on all the legal issues for the week in review.
The other thing I thought about, it was announcing my candidacy for the Republican president nomination, but I'm not allowed to lie in the hubbub. So
you'll be in Norwood tonight.
Yes, that's right.
I also want to declare this is not a precedent-setting moment for any of the rest of our Week in Review guests who are listening. You must come to the table
with a hubbub.
Okay. Mine, actually, speaking of Republican presidential candidates, is the Donald, who's coming to Massachusetts. He's going to be in Norwood this afternoon or evening at the home of Ernie Bach Jr. Nancy, you said I don't have a good poker face. You're lucky this is radio. Ernie Bach Jr., you know, everything you're looking for. And it's, I mean, the Donald Trump, he's currently still leading in the polls. I think he's 16 points ahead of Ben Carson, who is now number two in the latest polls. He's, you know, he's bringing the media circus along with him. So we'll see what happens this afternoon.
He's leading both in affirmatives and negatives. He's leading.
He's a winner across the board.
There you go.
He's not a loser.
Ernie Bach's opening his home. He's having a dinner and a party there. It's a fundraiser as well, but just $100 a head. So,
and a free car.
And well, that's my hubbub for the day. We'll see what happens tonight with the Donald. Nancy Gertner, former federal judge and current professor at Harvard Law School. Always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Jim Sturgis, executive director at the Pioneer Institute. Same. Always great to have you as well.
Good to be with you.
There's more in the moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.